You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that have made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Vice President of Creative Strategy, Innovation, and Business Development at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, discovering connections, and building a better future. This is Getting the Yes And.
We welcome Paul Eastwick back to the podcast. Paul is a professor of psychology at UC Davis, where he serves as the head of the Social Personality Psychology Program and the director of the Attraction and Relationships Research Laboratory. Thousands of undergraduate students have taken his course on attraction and close relationships, and he has published over 100 scientific articles and chapters and won numerous early career awards. His research and writing has been featured in outlets like The New York Times, The Atlantic, NPR, and Scientific American Mind. He hosts the popular podcast Love Factually with his longtime colleague Eli Finkel. You might remember we did a pod about that pod, where they analyze rom-coms and romantic dramas from the perspective of relationship science. But he has a new book. It's called Bonded by Evolution, What We've Got Wrong About Love and Connection. You're going to enjoy this pod. Paul Eastwick, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me back, Callie. I'm excited for this.
I want to start with something you write at the end of your new book. You write, quote, "I didn't write this book because I think I have all the answers. I wrote this book because I saw a creeping and pernicious pessimism supercharged by a handful of angry men online. It dawned on me that these men seem to have an outdated understanding of human attractions and relationships," end quote. What I love about that is this is not... You, like a great Second City show, you sneak in the harder hitting elements within the book proper. You don't lead with this idea.
Yeah. But
as you're reading it, it's like, oh, this is why this is important. And My God, if we don't see that going on right now, I think it's going on in the streets as we're taping this podcast.
I know. Yeah. I mean, I do think that... I've loved being a scientist and doing the scientist part of this whole endeavor. It's exciting to ask questions about how human attraction works and about how relationships work and to kind of see where the data takes you and to argue it out in scientific journals. That's been a blast. I'm very lucky that I've been able to do that. But there was something that started to happen, you know, in my sphere like 10 years ago when I started to notice that it wasn't just an academic debate anymore to talk about whether the nature of human attraction was about, you know, tens and twos and, you know, fighting it out for the best mate that you could get and being as impressive as you can be, or whether it was another story about attachment and closeness and vulnerability. Now, some of those ideas about competition, the ruthless ideas behind human mating, just got spun way out of control. Yeah. Online. And, you know, these folks claimed to be drawing from the science, and they were sort of, but it was an older science, an outdated science, and they were taking it to extremes that were not justified at all.
Yeah. And that is Jordan Peterson, certainly, and the sort of incel movement. But for someone who I think is maybe operating in slightly better faith, even what Scott Galloway talks about in terms of that. That's the problem, right? It's gotten that deep that even people who are very sincere in terms of Richard Reeves, who wants to help with this stuff, maybe is relying on what you really call is the Evo script. So let's get into what that is, because that is the basis of this book, that this idea that everyone knows about Darwinism, evolution, is telling us wrong ideas about our relationships.
Yeah, that's right. And right, even people who are like quote unquote on our side, I mean, we want to try to make things better and, you know, pursue progressive ideals. When it comes to things in, you know, matters of human attraction and relationships, everybody kind of freezes because we think I have a feeling there's some regressive stuff in there that I don't want to touch. So there are some scientific ideas in that sphere that have been around for a long time. And I think we overestimate their power in real life, and we overestimate how well those scientific ideas have held up. Yep. So I call this the Evo script. It refers to a few pillars of the evolutionary psychology of mating that I think came to fruition in the 90s, and they were very popular, and most people are familiar with them. And in my view, the science has shown the limitations of these ideas, mm-hmm. to put it mildly. So one of these ideas is the concept of mate value, which is really twinned with the idea that mating is a market. And we get in there and we battle it out. And you learn whether you're a 10 or a 6 or a 2. And your fate romantically is driven by how you fall within that hierarchy. The second idea that I tackle is the idea that men and women are really, really different in the romantic realm, that men want one thing and women want something else. And it's a tense, competitive vibe between the genders because our interests are so different. And the third idea that I tackle in there is that there are short-term relationships and long-term relationships, and these are different forms of relationships, and some people are good at one and some people are good at the other, and you kind of got to pick a lane. And I think all three of these ideas that I've just articulated, there is a little bit of truth to some components there and a whole great number of misconceptions.
Yeah, and those ideas are they have shown up in great literature over time, certainly movies, because you and Eli cover that. And then, though, the thing that really sort of like maybe when this would have gotten better as you're doing your science, as these other ideas coming, we start to do internet dating. We start to have these apps, and that's supercharged this problem, right?
Yeah. I mean, it is very common for people, when they think about dating and they think about attraction, their mind immediately goes to, well, if I want to do that well, I got to do well on the app. So I got to market myself, got to make myself look good, got to self-promote. Or I got to go to a bar and learn how to talk to strangers. Mm-hmm. I got to be really impressive on these coffee dates that I arrange through the apps, and I get 20 minutes to impress somebody. This is a mode of dating that is very tough for a lot of people, and I think pretty demoralizing. And one of the points that I wish to stress is that this is but one way to do it. And it happens to be an exceptionally modern way of doing it, and one that I think taps quite poorly into anything that one might want to say about our ancestral past. Because when we were evolving on the savannah tens or hundreds of thousands or millions of years ago, you didn't, for example, approach a lot of strangers, and you certainly didn't have apps, and you had a lot more than 20 minutes to make an impression on somebody, because we lived in small groups. And small groups afford people time to get to know each other. And it kind of turns out like time is in many ways the great equalizer when it comes to all things attraction related.
I was at a party last week, and someone was asking me about what I do, and I'm talking about Second City and my particular area, which is this applied improvisation. How we apply improvisation to all these different domains. And they go, have you ever done improv and dating? And I pause for a second because I'm like, we don't have to. It already happens.
It already is. I was going to say.
I mean, it's like, are you kidding me? I mean, I'm at my wife here. Like I can count the, I would need multiple hands to count the amount of relationships that have come out of here. And what I know, because what are you doing? For 8 weeks, you're meeting for 3 hours and looking someone else in the eye. And all your instruction is about how you have to like dig into the details of yourself and be true and be honest and not go into your fear and shame brain. Guess what?
Yeah. I mean, I did not intend to write a book that was secretly an ad for Second City improv classes, but I think maybe I did.
Maybe you did. I think you did.
Because it really is exactly the approach that I recommend to people. I mean, and honestly, for people who are struggling with the apps, which I think is a lot of people these days, I try to remind people, look, there was once a period of time where we would just hang out with other people for the sake of hanging out with other people.
That's right.
And especially if you can do so in ways that encourage repeated interaction, in ways that you can't opt out. I understand maybe that sounds a little bit like I'm trying to restrict people's freedom. I don't mean that. I just mean that those occasions where you get to hang out with the same people over and over again, those avenues still exist out there. Yep. What we see in the science when it comes to impression formation is that, yes, look, there is agreement when people first meet about who's attractive and who's not. So to some extent, it's speed dating, for example, there are tens and there are sixes and there are twos. But what that misses is that there's variability around those judgments. So everybody might say, oh, I'm a six. Okay. That's the average rating I receive. But some people think I'm an eight and some people think I'm a four.
Yeah.
And if I go to one of your classes, what will happen is that over time, that spread gets bigger. Yeah. So now some people think I'm a nine or even a 10. And some people think I'm like a two. I mean, some people are not, you know, not taken with me. And that's okay. Mm-hmm. Because what the market has done is the forces that created the hierarchy of mate value have weakened over time. And now there is more room for idiosyncrasy, more room for a lot of people to find somebody that they're especially into. And then you sort of hope that the other person is especially into you. And that's kind of where the magic happens.
There's another line, and this really struck me in the book, where you say, quote, people don't really have a stable type, end quote. I want everyone listening to this podcast to think about the different people you've had like semi-long-term relationships with. Because when I did that, I'm like, this makes no sense. No one I dated was like, for a period of time, was like anyone else. It was all over the map.
Yeah. I mean, if somebody did an audit of my dating life, they would say, well, why do you keep dating fellow psychologists and academics? And I would say, well, it's because like that's who I'm meeting. And if you get beyond that, beyond the pool of people that I am meeting, it's not a lot of similarities. And that's often what we see in the data is that people, like you think you have a type, but a lot of it is driven by just where you are and who you're meeting and who you're surrounded by. So, and some of that has to do with the, you know, broader things like SES, right? Mm-hmm. And some of that has to do with the little niches that we create for ourselves because of the things that we like and we enjoy doing. Like given their own devices, the theater kids are going to date the other theater kids. But if I bring them speed dating and have them meet a few jocks and a few band geeks, now all bets are off. And that's what we tend to see is that like the stability really comes from who you're meeting, not what you feel once you're actually interacting with them. This is kind of a tricky double-edged sword because what it means is that if you have your heart set on dating a particular person, like, you know, I'm a little older. Like if you imagine dating and like if you already have kids, you don't want to have kids, any more kids. The only way to shape who you're going to fall for is to shape the pool of people that you're going to meet. Because if you meet enough people who maybe don't have the attributes that you would draw up on paper, like I have news, you might fall for them. And, you know, then things get complicated.
So I went to Ithaca College for a year, the less smart hill in Ithaca, New York. And I made great friends who I'm still in touch with today, but I didn't really
enjoy. You all were far more interesting on that hill, I have to
say.
Well,
yeah. Well, yeah, yes and no. So, I was just Sly Dunbar just died, who is the great drummer with Robbie Shakespeare, who is the great bassist. We're the Black Uhuru, and there were a bunch. And he just died, and I remember seeing him like four times. And
wow.
So I was texting with my old Ithaca friends. But I ended up Kurt Vonnegut was teaching at Cornell at that time, so I would audit his class. I'd go to other classes over there to audit. I did much better with the Cornell girls than I did with the Ithaca
College girls.
And I don't know. And I always felt a little bit like imposter syndrome there. But you were you in grad school at Cornell, or does that
No, that was undergrad. It's so funny because I remember one time interacting with a girl from Ithaca College. This was like through a program where we were helping out high school kids, and I was just like so taken with her. I was like, you're really different. Oh, you seem cool. I don't think she felt that way about me, but it's just like, oh, what's going on the other hill over there? That's interesting.
Well, and that's not the story you tell in the book about yourself. So why don't we, let's talk about that one, because it was a girl. You ran into a girl from your hometown, right?
Right. So this was a lesson for me in what it's like to try to go outside your league. I met somebody at Cornell, but she was from my hometown. She was very outgoing, very sociable, just kind of approached me like she knew who I was. And I'm like, you're gorgeous and absolutely have it entirely put together. Why are you talking to me right now? And we became friends. And it was a genuine friendship for a long period of time. And I thought this was going somewhere. And, but it turned out, spoiler alert, that it really wasn't. And that, that was a useful lesson in, I just don't have the same things going on that she did. And I use this as a way of talking about how people often, quote unquote, learn their place when it comes to mate value, when it comes to appeal. And the science runs wild with this. I mean, we've got class demos where we make people re-experience what I felt, feeling like, oh, like this person might want to be friends with me, but they are definitely not into me. But I also talk about how time changes a lot of this, that a lot of the agreement that we see is limited to initial impressions. And as people get to know each other over time, those impressions start to shift and change. And a year later, I'm still friends with this person. I mean, I'm still friends with her to this day.
Yeah.
But a year later, it wasn't the same. And it wasn't like, oh, I learned who she really was and that person wasn't as it wasn't it. It was that, I started to see maybe the ways in which we weren't a perfect fit together. She became less intimidating. And, the romantic spark wasn't what it was. It was a friendship, and that was good. And the friendship was good for other things in my life in other ways. So it ends up kind of becoming a positive story, in my memory, as opposed to, what I think a lot of people would have taken it to a nasty place. But that wasn't how I experienced it. And I really think, we have a choice in how we interpret these kinds of events and what we do in cases like this.
Also importantly, you say in the book, quote, you can tell that human close relationships are important by focusing on what happens when they end. And I thought about that with regard to very first girlfriend. Well, maybe second girlfriend. But the first one that I was like head over heels, her name was Allison. To this day, if Elvis Costello's Allison comes on, that is what I think about. And it was really a painful breakup. I'm in my second marriage. I'm very happy in this marriage. And yet this is and she probably listens to the podcast because I'm on social media with her. That is why this is so important, because about it, that the hurt is real.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that experience too, I think is well reflected by the science, in the sense that we can see when people go through breakups that they become very dysregulated. They have lost, in many cases, what we would call an attachment figure. And that's like one of the points that I really want to stress, is that we are creatures who bond to each other. We form these attachments to each other. And that's really the core of what human relationships are. You want to feel like somebody's supporting you, that they've got your back, that they're going to celebrate you. And so when you break up, not only have you lost something important to you, you've lost the person that you would usually go to when you lose something. So you've lost the important thing and the support at the same time. So it's very, very challenging for people in that sense. The body gets used to having another person around. And so now if that person's gone, we become physiologically dysregulated. It's an exceptionally distressing experience. And I don't think that experience is captured very well by tens and twos and you got to fight your way up the market. I think it's better captured by concepts like attachment and bonding.
Yeah, because you point to the science of the fact that like mismatched couples don't break up with any more frequency than what we would call a matched couple.
Yeah, that's right. We don't see any evidence of this. And I think there's a sense in which this is counterintuitive because, again, if you think about it like a competitive market, here we got an 8 dating a 5, okay? Air quotes around the 5, okay? So you think, well, if an 8 comes along who's interested in the 8, that relationship is in trouble, surely. But we got to understand a couple of things. First of all, if the 8 is in a relationship with the 5, the 8 doesn't think the 5's a 5. The 8 probably thinks that the 5 is an 8 or a 9 or a 10, all right? So now whoever the alternative is, whoever the competitor is, they've got a hurdle they've got to get over. And it doesn't help that people tend to do something when they're in relationships. They do this thing we call derogation of alternatives, which is, it's not just that they think their partner is super amazing relative to what other people think. They think the potential alternatives are like worse than they quote unquote actually are. So this 8 who's coming in and is competing, well, you know, she thinks he's a 6. So it's an enormous gap that people have to overcome. Because of all these motivated reasoning forces. Now, this motivated reasoning doesn't always work. There are many times where it falters. Relationships do break up. But I think this explains why any sort of like mismatch, it's a mismatch in how you appear to other people. It doesn't explain at all how you feel about each other. That's the thing that'll determine whether a relationship breaks up. It doesn't have anything to do with you know, whether you're defending your relationship against alternatives. And it certainly has nothing to do with the history that two people build together. That history is oftentimes what keeps people together. And, you know, that too can be a double-edged sword because history can be the thing that gives a relationship life, but it can also be the things that, you know, drive a relationship into a ditch. So generally speaking, I think when we think about mismatched couples, we are focused too much on, oh, what other people think and not about what's going on internally in that relationship.
I remember someone once saying to me that their view of a successful marriage was when each party thinks that they kind of won. They got the better deal.
Yes.
And that really struck me as true. Yeah, right. It struck me as true at the time. And it's interesting at Second City. So my wife, Ann, and I, we met here and we met in the context of getting married to other people. So my current wife, Ann Libra, caught the bouquet at my wedding, my first wedding.
Whoa.
Yes.
That's good. That's a good story.
It's good. And then, you know, a few weeks later, we were at her wedding and she was married. We're both at Second City and she married another Second City person. My wife was an actor, but not at Second City. And when we broke up and then Ann and I got together, so this is, you know, like 30 years ago or whatever, people were freaked out. They were like, this doesn't make any sense whatsoever. Today, when I tell the story to people, they're like, that doesn't make – you are perfect for each other.
Yeah.
Like, that is the view. And I always find it funny because I remember clear as day, and so does Anne, how people perceive this and to have that change. But I think to the book, you talk about over the period of the time what happens with your story and then how you navigate things in terms of like we never keep score.
Yeah.
In terms of like – what we're doing for each other. It's like we just don't do that. And we've had to do a lot for each other in different contexts.
Yeah. I mean, I think when we think about relationships and like what makes two people work or not work, there's a temptation to think, that it's like a chemical reaction, like all the pieces are there. And it's just about putting the pieces together in the right way. And if the chemical reaction goes the way that it's supposed to go, these pieces fit here and these pieces fit here, and it just works. And as time has gone on, I've come to see that that's not a great metaphor for thinking about how relationships take shape, and that I instead prefer a metaphor that's closer to construction or building something, but without a blueprint. Mm-hmm. Two kids in a sandbox, kind of trying to create a structure, you know, but kind of messing around at the same time. And hopefully two people create something that works for them. It's not always easy to do because you don't know where this thing is going, but we often talk about relationships as their own little cultures, their own little microcultures. And these cultures consist of rituals and patterns, the things that people do in their daily lives that are often set pretty early on. And that are a lot of the things that give us joy in relationships. Like for me, it's the dinners that I have with my partner or with my family. Like those are really important for finding connection with each other. At the same time, some of the patterns that we develop, you know, maybe with some couples, like once they have kids, they stop having time together in the evenings because they're so focused on childcare, and you don't realize how the pattern was serving you. And this is where couples can then confront intimacy challenges in their relationships because their patterns were disrupted and they didn't quite realize it. So I think that this is a better way of thinking about it, that relationships are constructed from thousands of tiny decisions that are very, very hard for people to unwind. And it is sort of an improvisational game in a way that two people are playing. And you know, there's no exact playbook exactly, although there are certainly things you can do to try to be mindful of the decisions that you're making and try to be aware of where patterns aren't serving you well anymore.
My friend and colleague, Heather Caruso, who was at the University of Chicago, I worked with her, she's at UCLA now. Used to always talk about the ladder metaphor being terrible. Whether it's climbing for corporate success or, you know, whatever. And she used to say it should be more like, you know, you're building some sort of house and sometimes you get an addition and sometimes you have to like go downgrade to an apartment. Yeah. And what that speaks to is the malleability and the flexibility as you grow with your partner, because you will change. Yeah. Each of you in your own unique ways, and you giving space for that change and allowing the change to happen. And the gift of that is being able to be renewed with interest in this person who is changing, as opposed to the narrative we see all the time, which is you've changed and that's a bad thing.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, can we get this idea that, like, I think this is more of a thing these days. I think maybe with some of the, you know, delayed adolescence and emerging adulthood and people delaying when they form serious relationships, I'm not exactly sure whether the rise of singles these days is truly a rise of singles or just a delay in when people form serious relationships, move in, settle down, etc. But there is this sense that, like, oh, you got to be a fully formed, stable, complete person to get in a relationship in the first place, or else, I don't know, you'll do it wrong. You'll pick poorly. But I don't know. That's not what I see in the evidence. What I see in the evidence is that when people get in a relationship, they change who they are. They change what their interests are. They change what their values are. And I think that's kind of a wonderful thing. It's a wonderful thing to have your mind expanded by being with somebody new and getting to know them. And that will continue to happen over time in a relationship as it persists. And part of what I think is hard for people is that once we've formed a set of rituals and a set of patterns, and you are a person who, you know, you do your workouts like this and you approach your job like this, it's a little scary when that changes. But there's a sense in which, you know, early on in a relationship, this all would have been exciting. Mm-hmm. And I think looking at a partner's growth as an opportunity to get excited again about what the partner is experiencing and how that partner is going to change, and then being willing to move with that to some extent, I think is a wise thing to do. It's not always easy, but I do think it's wise if it's possible.
So I'm curious about your field of relationship science, which is relatively new to me. I think when I was researching for our last conversation with Eli, that's when I was like, oh, I don't know that much about this, and I do about these sort of other areas. But so my question is, like, how applicable is the science that you're working on to any of the relationships I've got at work, at home?
Yeah. It's relevant to many of them. I would say that there are, in many ways, the things that we find about friendships, any kind of close relationships, tend to be broadly applicable. There are a few fun differences that I'll often talk about in my class. So, for example, when it comes to being romantically selective versus platonically selective, being, you know, desperate to date anybody is not considered to be a very good thing, but kind of being open to being friends with anybody. I mean, you know, sort of imagine, like, you know, first day of camp vibes.
Yeah.
If you seem eager to be friends with everybody, that's a good thing. If you seem eager to date everybody, not great. That's not great. So that's one area where there's a difference. But for the most part, a lot of what we see carries over. And probably the best example of that is what we call the fast friends procedure. This actually started as a romantic experiment to get two, you know, heterosexual men and women into each other in a short period of time by getting them to disclose vulnerable things about themselves over the course of an hour or two. But it works very well. And I kind of think about it like it's like a little bit of an improvisational tool that you're giving people, but it works just as well in the platonic realm too. So you see people do this with platonic context, friendship context all the time. So a lot of those core principles apply even beyond romantic settings.
Yeah. I think in our exchange, I was telling you about Leslie John's latest book on self-disclosure. And that's, we did all that work with Nick Epley on self-disclosure in part because, and we, when we were working with the hostage negotiation team at the FBI before Kash Patel,
The
FBI's not inviting Second City back right now.
Yeah. Right. Right.
I'm telling that right now, but they really dug the self-disclosure exercises, and you can imagine, if you're working with someone who's holding a hostage, you need to build trust very quickly with this person. You're not going to have a romantic relationship with them, hopefully. But you do need to create that bond. And that is that sharing something even slightly vulnerable about yourself and having them mirror that and then scaling that appropriately with both parties just creates a really very powerful layer in which you can pro-socially negotiate the thing at hand.
Absolutely. You know, we talked a little bit about sort of having a type and, you know, what makes two people click. And boy, it is very hard to assess features of two people before they meet and predict who's going to click with each other. I drop what I want on paper. I introduce you to that person, and not any more or less likely to like that person than random chance. Which starts to sound like I'm saying, well, I don't know, anybody can be compatible with anybody. And that maybe sounds a little bit outlandish. But I like to remind folks that the single best tool that we have for creating a pair that will like each other is this procedure that you're talking about. You send people into an interaction, you give them 30, 45 minutes, an hour, and they build up to questions like, if you had a crystal ball that could tell you anything about the future, what would you want to know? Or what is something that you've never told anybody that you wish you had and what's stopping you? Or questions like, what is something you really like about this person that you've just met for an hour? Huge effect sizes on how much people like each other. So given the right tools, I do think that people can hit it off with other people, I think oftentimes better than we think, if given the right tools and under the right circumstances.
And again, not to make this an infomercial for Second City, because I'm about to.
I love this. A good bit.
I'm glad you do. Being a good listener, simply listening well, which is, and by the way, the reason it's so powerful, we're terrible at it.
Yeah.
We're really, we are normally planning our response, which I can't, if I want to have a successful conversation with you, which I do, I have all these notes. I probably asked you 4 questions from the notes. The rest is just, I'm listening to what you're saying and I'm responding. And that is why it appears to be authentic and why it is.
Yeah. You know, I can't tell you how often, like when I'm having a conversation with my partner in the evening, like I'm just like creating these lists of like the things that I want to say. And that too, that's a complicated thing, because like I really do feel like, oh, I do feel better if I'm able to like disclose and get off my chest all the things that I want to talk about. But also she's got things that she wants to disclose and that she wants to talk about as well. And you got to do that reflection to know, like, this experience that I'm having, the other person is having this too. So if I'm going to be disclosing, I also need to spend some time being a good listener as well. And, you know, reflect back what she's saying. I can't just like be trying to get to my next thing. That is not a recipe for good interaction. It's hard to do.
Yeah. We've had Caroline Fleck on the podcast who spoke about validation. And that to me was it's still a very powerful tool to simply validate the feeling of the person across from you and nothing else. And you're like, wow, I can't believe how good the rest of that conversation went when in other circumstances, it's me trying to fix me trying to brush off whatever it is, just validate and see what happens.
Yep. Yeah. Many times, you know, when people wonder, like, how do I handle conflict in my relationship? Because, I mean, conflict is basically inevitable.
Yep.
But there are different tools and, you know, ways of handling it that can go better or worse. And validation is an important tool to use to have things go better. Things that just show that you're listening. Like, you don't have to have the solution right then and there. Sometimes it's just about like, hey, like, I see where you're coming from. And also, you know, I was upset about this thing, but I acknowledge that things have improved. You know, these sorts of techniques are so much better than I think when we feel like the righteous indignation, we feel wronged, we feel that things are unfair. Boy, it's so hard to resist coming at conflict with a, you know, a bookkeeping mentality, right? The ledger. But usually the ledger is a bad sign. And if people can throw away the ledger, I encourage them to do so whenever possible.
All right. For returning guests to the podcast, rather than a yes and story, because you've already done that for us, we ask you if you've got a thank you because story, a time in which you didn't really want a yes and, but you saw the other person, you tried to see some value in what they said, and then what happened when you did that?
Well, I think I've got a good example of it from this past weekend with my partner, because she and I have very different preferences for like how we organize the weekends. I want things to be really structured. I want to know exactly when things are happening. And she prefers more spontaneity. And I didn't really want to have this discussion this weekend. I just wanted to like get two things and get things done. But she more or less insisted that we kind of sit down and that she talked through what her preferences were. And honestly, the reason I think it's a thank you because story is because honestly, listening to her talk through her preferences and me being able to sit there non-defensively, which is very hard for me, but being able to sit there non-defensively, it actually opened up my awareness of why my own preferences are the way that they are, that sometimes it's about anxiety and about worrying that like, I'm not going to be able to get to something if I don't know exactly when it's happening. And by getting to that core, we're actually better able to come to like an understanding that, oh, it doesn't have to be like just your way or just my way. If we go at the core, like my anxiety is this and your concerns are this, we can just kind of make it better for everybody. So I didn't want to have that conversation, but ultimately I was very glad that we had it.
I love that because it's messy. You know?
Yeah. It's not easier,
but it is infinitely more interesting to play with that.
Yeah, right. You learn something.
Yeah, you learn something. The book is called Bonded by Evolution, What We've Got Wrong About Love and Connection. Everyone should get this book. Paul Eastwick, thank you for coming on the pod.
Thank you so much for having me.
Getting DS And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor is Iridian Fierro from WGN. We get support at the Second City from Emma Smith and Colleen Fahey. For more information about the Second City, you can go to www.secondcity.com or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.